The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight's guest, Mike Rasso of Pop Cinema, formerly known as EI Entertainment, on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema. This is a forum where we explore genre film and music from around the world, in-depth conversation and career analysis with directors, actors, and musicians, and open discussion on films that matter, those that fall outside the mainstream corporate film by boardroom committee. These are the province of the auteur, the visionary, the dreamer, the outsider. Join us as we delve deep into the cinematic netherworld here on Third Eye Cinema. We'll be your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema with a focus on film that matters. Cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. None of that director passes for mainstream film these days. This is all about the glory days of independent cinema and major studio cinema too when certain conditions apply to make their films of interest. From all over the U.S., Canada, Italy, France, Spain, Germany, Indonesia, India, the Philippines, Japan, Hong Kong, or any of the hotbeds of obscure, oddball, or generally wild cinema available on DVD, from the dawn of the medium to this very day. Just don't blame us if we focus on those filmmakers who are still going strong in the field of independent cult film as well. Tonight, we'll be speaking to Mike Rasso, founder of Pop Cinema, formerly known as EI Entertainment Cinema, encompassing the alternative cinema website and catalog, 80s SOV leader Camp Motion Pictures, Retro Seduction Cinema, home to numerous Joe Sarno and Nick Phillips pictures, Shockorama, home of Brett Piper, and Seduction Cinema of homegrown stars Darian Kane and Misty Monday. Mike also holds his own alternative cinema podcast and is a major player in the film-based photography movement. Join us as we discuss SOV Cinema, Joe Sarno, Misty Monday, and the future of the DVD industry, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Mike Rasso is the impresario behind Pop Cinema, formerly known as EI Independent Cinema, whose many subdivisions and labels include Camp Motion Pictures, Retro Seduction Cinema, Shockorama, and Secret Key, among others. They've been a major force in the SOV revival, being responsible for releases of numerous 80s shot on video store classics by such directors as the Polonia Brothers, Tim Ritter, Gary Cohen, John McBride, Todd Sheets, and Tim O'Rourke, with whom Mike Rasso was cinematographer on both The Basement and Ghoul School. He's been a major, if not exclusive, source of DVD releases of long-lost classic films with such directors as Joe Sarno, Nick Phillips, and even the first Doris Wishman film, as well as releases from Jess Franco, Bruno Mattei, David Durston, and Al Adamson. His Shockorama labels brought us several new films from the likes of Brett Piper, and Secret Key has provided us with numerous films from 60s and 70s sirens like Rene Bond and Uschi Degar. And their Seduction Cinema line has built something of an empire around softcore starlets Misty Monday and Darian Kane, in all a notably large and diverse pool of independent cinema, both classic and current. He also produces both the Alternative Cinema Podcast at AlternativeCinemaPodcast.com and the Film Photography Podcast at FilmPhotographyProject.com. Mike, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, it's great to be here.
I understand you built the company while you were working at Audiovision, and the story behind it is somewhat amusing. Tell us about the birth of EI Cinema.
Audiovision was a industrial video company, would produce corporate videos. Okay. And right out of college, always making films, short films, et cetera, so forth. But right out of college, of course, you have to eat, so you have to get a job.
Right.
So I knew the owner of Audiovision because I bought supplies for the various wedding videos I used to shoot.
Right.
After a few years, I approached Audiovision with the idea of me bringing my new company, EI Independent Cinema, letting me rent out an office to use, which he informed me that he had no space. And I was very persistent, and I pointed out that he had a fax closet. I'm not even joking. He had a fax closet. I said, well, what if, you moved your fax machine out and you put a desk in there? And we chatted it out. We talked it out. Finally, he said, sure, come on in, with a stipulation that I would be bringing work in for him, corporate work.
Right.
And I already had corporate clients of my own and was very active out shooting corporate videos. So I came in. It actually worked out pretty good. Our sensibilities were the same. So,
right.
You know, we knew each other, and I knew all the people there, and it worked out very well. So my first office was on Bloomfield Avenue in Bloomfield.
Right.
And that's where I started my first office.
Yeah, my partner, Matt, who had worked with you at that AudioVision, had mentioned that you also had a secretary. I think she was also in the fax closet.
No. The secretary belonged to AudioVision. There was
okay.
a central secretary. And what I did was I wired up a separate phone, and it was a single-line phone, and
right.
it said EI Communications on it,
right?
Because many of the corporate clients would call for EI.
Right.
So she would pick up our phone, take messages, and I'm sure she took some kind of bizarre messages, too.
I'd also like to make a brief mention of William Hellfire, who I believe also worked with you at that point, as he's gone on to produce a number of excellent releases for the various subdivisions of Media Blasters.
I met William in Newark at a rock club. A friend of mine, Pete Jackalone, produced a shot-on-video feature called Psycho Sisters.
Okay.
Not the Psycho Sisters. We remade Psycho Sisters a few years later
right.
with EI.
Right.
But he shot like a demo almost.
Okay.
And in Psycho Sisters, he had a bunch of local bands, and Pete was like, come on down to the bar. You know, we're going to have bands playing. Pete, always very enthusiastic and excited about his movie making.
Right.
We're going to have screens. We're going to have bands. I went down, and he introduced me to William Hellfire. He was sitting down, crouched in the corner, a small-framed, like, 22-year-old boy.
Right.
And we started talking, and we hit it off. And in talking to him, I found out that he was a Javalia salesman.
Okay.
Javalia is a coffee company
right.
where you know, people call you on the phone. You know, phone sales.
Right.
Good morning, Mrs. Smith. I want to tell you about our Javalia coffee offer. And if you pick up 3 packs of coffee, you get a coffee maker. True. So I thought at that time, videos were distributed on VHS.
Right.
And we were really just starting out, and the mission was to get videos into video stores.
Right.
And since William had phone sales, loved music, loved movies, he was the first EI employee to come in.
Okay.
And when I say employee, I mean that really loosely. I mean, you come in, you do the phone sales, you take a percentage, and I buy you a sandwich. So William came in, did phone sales, selling whatever wares we had early on, and they were sort of the mid-90s independents, like J.R. Bookwalter and
right.
Todd Sheets
right.
and Kevin Lindemuth.
Right.
And I handcrafted a little catalog and, you know, went to Staples and got copied.
Right. Let us in on how you managed to build what started out as a rather small business concern into what's become something of a media empire with various distribution arms, a substantive production arm, and even a direct sales outlet with Alternative Cinema, where you sell not only your own titles, but also those of several great independent companies I'm a fan of, particularly Code Red, but also Synapse, Blue Underground, Media Blasters, yeah. and more.
If this was the AC podcast, which I produce and host, alternativecinemapodcast.com, there would be a laugh track after you said empire.
Well, everything's relative.
yeah. Well, it started out as simple as that, which is the idea of bringing independents together with a unified distribution.
Right.
Because I am of the belief, was always of the belief, and still am of the belief that independent filmmakers should not distribute because it's a conflict. If you're an independent filmmaker and you want to distribute and you start taking on other people's films to distribute, first
right.
of all, that's a huge responsibility because
right.
you're making a commitment to that filmmaker that you're going to do the best job you can. And maybe at first you will, but if you're a filmmaker, what happens when you're gone for 6 months shooting your film and there's no one at your office?
True.
So I say that because you're looking at a guy who went to school to be a filmmaker
right.
and became a home video entertainment company, and I had to leave filmmaking behind. I mean, I dabbled here and there.
Right.
But once I took on the job of distributing other people's movies, I had to make that a full-time job. Everything's really come full circle from the beginning days in the mid-90s where I would either wholesale other filmmakers' movies to sell through the catalog
right.
or do a distribution deal.
Right.
And then once my company, EI, started developing its own labels, like Shockarama and Seduction Cinema,
right.
and started, you know, taking on more employees, and we became real. In the 2000s, we were so busy producing
right.
that the whole the whole alternative cinema, which is its own entity.
Right.
If you ask me what alternative cinema did, like 2002 to 2004, I know it was there.
Right.
I know Justin was there working there as he is now.
Right.
But I can't tell you what went on because everything was so focused on producing our own stuff.
Right.
And getting it on TV and out on DVD. And here we are all these years later in 2012. And once again, alternative cinema is very much what it used to be, which is, and it's because the format of DVD is, you know, on the wane.
Right.
That now more than ever, there needs to be a unified Columbia House, so to speak.
Right.
A unified place where alternative cinema can carry all the releases from everyone, so a fan can go to a catalog and say, oh, we got Blue Underground,
right,
to Shockarama, Synapse Films, Code Red, Severin Film. That happened a few years ago when I realized, I'm like, oh my God, the DVD is going to go the way of the dinosaur,
right?
And I have this great company, and we have this mail order department,
right?
We have this great, you know, pick, pack, and ship operation.
Right.
Let's carry everything.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that impressed me is I saw you carry basically rival companies. I'm like, wow, this is nice.
Yeah.
It's not just the EI catalog, it's all these other catalogs as well.
Yeah.
Can you speak to some of the challenges faced by an independent DVD distributor in the current market, as you were mentioning, not only in relation to the current economic climate, but in terms of the apparent decline of DVD as a medium in favor of a more rental-based and temporary streaming milieu that eschews actual ownership?
Oh, my God. The DVD format is really almost gone. I mean, the format will be around for a few years, maybe 5 years, maybe 6 years, maybe longer. But, I mean, look at vinyl.
Right.
I mean, I still buy vinyl, but I'm like the only person, you know, I mean, I tend to hang out with people of like-minded, you know,
right.
Hey, collect vinyl, you know. But the DVD format, it's not gone yet. And I look at mainstream, and I want to look at mainstream, I look at my parents, and I look at my family.
Right.
You know, they are renting through Netflix, and
right.
They love it. They love to watch DVDs. But if you look at someone who's 17 or 25,
right.
The 17-year-old is glued to a handheld device. As a matter of fact, when they're walking, they're not even looking forward anymore.
Exactly.
They're just looking down. And the 25-year-old, 20 to 25, college-aged, everything's a laptop and a notebook.
Right.
Like the world, you know, is the notebook and laptop. And there is no TV. It's just whatever, oh, hey, I want to see, oh, my God, you know, Misty Monday's in that new HBO lingerie. You know, let me watch it, legal or illegal.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter. So I'm hoping that the DVD will stick around very much like the vinyl record for a collector.
Right.
Who wants something special.
Right.
The liner notes, the DVD extras. The world as we know it as far as media is evolving right now.
Yes.
And I don't believe that the streaming platform is fully realized yet. It's starting out, and you have Netflix, and you have Hulu, but I think that's probably going to really evolve in the next few years.
Yeah.
And hopefully put the power into the hands of the viewer to say, I want to watch Herschel Gordon Lewis Blood Feast.
Right.
And then you just go to your computer, type it in, and there is a legal way to see it.
On your end, as a distributor, how is this impacting, or how do you think it will impact you?
Well, we went from a thriving, bustling production company and distribution company to a much smaller, you know, really pared down operation. We were double, if not triple, the amount of people just 8 years ago.
Right.
What's going on in the DVD business is really a reflection of what's going on in the world, which is an amazing financial disaster as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
It's affecting every single person, and that every single person, it's like a whole domino effect. You know, we don't produce as many DVDs, so what happens to all those DVD manufacturers that were doing work for us?
Exactly.
So everything's consolidated, and many labels have either shut down or have done the same. It's a time, I think, that if someone running a company didn't have any passion for it, that they would just close shop and move on
yeah.
to something else.
Right.
Because, you know, saying it's a struggle in this year, in 2012 and 2011, you know, it's very much an understatement.
Yeah, this is still related, and you may have already addressed this to some extent, but personally speaking, I'm not a fan of the new rules. I'm very much old school, and I like to have my purchases in hand to collect, view whenever I want, or sell off if I need the cash. But this is a major issue, those few companies still standing, many of whom are still distributed or at least available for sale in their alternative cinemas catalog, are facing today. How are you looking towards addressing a possible future where all the ground rules have changed?
When you say the ground rules change, you're talking about how to watch a movie?
Yeah, we're talking about how everything is really moving towards this streaming rental milieu. So how are you going to address this as a company, besides paring down and just trying to go with the flow? Do you have any business strategy towards this?
There really is. There are factors involved that have little to do with us. For example, I read that Sony in this year or next year is going to stop pressing music CDs.
Right.
So when a much larger entity or someone that kind of is gatekeeper or controls the manufacturing or the way things are, the way media is digested by a consumer, some of those decisions are made for us already. So
right.
We have very little power to, you know, bring back. We have no power as far as bringing back a DVD. I mean,
right.
Best Buy has already decided we're cutting down,
yes.
And, you know, only carrying the hits. And when stores no longer exist, you can't live in the past,
right.
Whatever you do, and you have to be prepared and have a vision to move forward.
That's what I was trying to address. Like, what is your vision for this?
If you're a late adapter, too, you could make some decisions that are not necessarily the right decision.
Right.
You know, for example, years ago, Netflix had an offer to us to stream quite a bit of our stuff, but the money wasn't right, so we turned it down.
Right.
Now, that was 3 years ago or 4 years ago. So back then, I didn't comprehend the fact that the medium is moving towards a pay-per-view, or, you know, I sort of think of it as an album LP and a 45 RPM record.
Right.
You know, right now it's like a 45 RPM record society. You go
yes.
to iTunes, you pay 99 cents, you buy
a single song,
buy
a
single
record, right? So.
Or you could buy the album. And the same thing for movies. It's like I never really felt that. The movies that we produced should be able to be bought for $1.99. I felt it was too little. How am I going to make money? I needed to be a little more forward-thinking and embrace it, regardless of whether there's money there or not, because that is what the technology is going to be, and there's no fighting it. So
right.
You can either fight it and just hold, you know, sit on your pile of movies and don't do anything, or you could embrace it and say, okay. You know, also, you have to understand from a producer's perspective of making hard goods, which is a DVD or a master, there's always something tangible in my hand to give to someone.
Right.
And once you start distributing files, to me it's mind-blowing in the sense that it seems to open a gateway to piracy.
Yes.
But once again, I'm fighting something that the battle is already over, and I'm there in my uniform.
Right.
You know, the battle's over. You search any Misty Monday film or any Chakarama movie or anything from my studio, and you will find an illegal source to watch it.
Yeah.
So since it's already there, what am I fighting? Nothing. So I think that the way to survive and is to just deal with what's going on and accept it, try to make wise decisions, and try to have something to sustain you during that period. And that's easier said than done, and the
yeah.
only reason that I think that my companies have survived is because we kind of have a lot of things going on at once,
right.
Which is the alternative cinema catalog as well as the studio. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, you did.
Oh.
It was a difficult, many-part question.
That's a tough question.
Okay, so let's shift gears for a minute and talk about your start as a cinematographer on the two Tim O. Roth films.
Oh, boy.
The Basement and Ghoul School. How'd you get involved with Tim on these projects?
Well, sort of the regular... You know, the usual suspects back in the day were myself, Tim O'Raw, Jeffrey Faoro, John Fedeli.
Right.
And these are guys I all went to college with, and now I can call my college William Patterson University.
That's right, it wasn't a university back then.
Now I can say, at university, back in the day it was Bill on the Hill
yep.
with Thursday Night Pub Night. A lot of the themes I'm going to talk about passion, I could talk about in many of the questions you ask, because there was a very small film department at William Patterson University. But you found this core group of guys that were just like so hardcore about it. You know, guys just wanted to make movies. And I was one of those guys who, you know, I took all my video courses and they were fine. But to me, you know, I'm sure video guys would like think I had my nose up in the air. It's like, it's film. Like, it was film. If you're going to do anything, you shoot it on film. And there are a small group of guys there. And we took all these film classes together.
Right.
And, you know, as part of the exercise for your class, you know, you would go out with a camera and start shooting movies. And Tim O'Raw, Tim is a producer at heart. He is what I would consider, if I had to give him a job description, I would say he is a producer.
Right.
Is he a writer-director? He can do that, but he is a producer because he's got the sort of like the hound dog sense. He started writing scripts and utilizing the class time to actually start making his short movies. And since the guy had a script, the teacher was like, okay, great, let's shoot this scene.
Right.
And many of these scenes are in these short films that are on, like, the Ghoul School Splatter University edition, or maybe on the basement, these little black and white films that Tim made.
Yeah.
At that time, I always say I'm the guy painting the fence in Tom Sawyer, and I'm painting this fence, and people start coming up to me, hey, man, what are you doing? Oh, I'm painting the fence. But back then, it was Tim all the way.
Right.
Tim was like the driving force. You know, so Tim had the script, and he was painting his fence. I'd be like, hey, man, what are you doing? Oh, well, you know, I want to get into horror. And he was so early on into, like, Fangoria and, you know, had, like, Wes Craven's home phone number.
Wow.
George Romero's home phone number. Like, he was just, like, good at that.
Right.
You know, whereas me, I'm much more to myself. Never had any business sense, anything. I was just, I wanted to shoot movies. I wanted to get behind a camera.
Right.
And I wanted to be a cinematographer.
Right.
So that was the perfect combination in college because Tim didn't know anything technical.
Right.
And he was the producer, writer, director. So he needed a bunch of dopes. Us, me, Jeff, John. He needed a bunch of guys to actually execute his short films,
right. Okay.
Which every one of his short films was a demo to send to get money for a feature film.
Right.
So he was O'Gore Productions, Tim O'Raw,
okay.
Nice Irish boy. He lived in Wayne, New Jersey, and his place was like the kind of meeting ground during college, you know, after college, and it was always like we relied on Tim to get the deals.
Right.
In order for us to do what we wanted to do, which was, for me, only thinking very narrowly about, you know, I'm looking up film stocks and cameras, and, I mean, that was, Tim was the opportunity for me to actually practice my craft.
Right.
Yeah.
Tonight we're speaking with Mike Rasso of EI Cinema. Coming up next, we'll discuss Ghoul School, The Basement, Misty Monday, and Brett Piper, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
In terms of Ghoul School, that was filmed at William Patterson College, right?
Oh, yes, it was.
Both of you obviously were attendees of the school.
Well, university.
Okay, excuse me, university, you're correct.
Thank you.
So I was going to ask you, how did you get access to film there? But I guess it's because you were both in the film department.
We were all alumni.
Okay.
So the time we shot Ghoul School, you know, we were all graduated alumni. And it was just a matter of going to the Alumni Association,
mm-hmm.
saying, hey, we want to shoot this movie. They booked us over the break, the winter break.
Right.
And Tim had keys to all the buildings. You know, to this day, like 2 years ago, I went to a screening at William Patterson University.
Right.
And the woman in the library is like, you know, they shot a movie here. I'm like, no, really? It's like, yeah, some horror movie. It's like, I'm glad that, you know, even though I thought the movie never got much play, Ghoul School,
right?
That, you know, I guess it's like, you know, as generation to generation, it's like, they shot a movie here once.
That's what it is. It gets legs that you don't know about.
Yeah.
How'd you manage to pull in two local colorful personalities, much less ones that couldn't be more different in personality, focus, or audience, as Jackie the Joke Man Martling and Joe Franklin?
Tim O'Raw. Tim was using a young woman by the name of Pamela Kramer to help cast, and she knew Joe, and I think she knew Jackie.
Okay.
Since she cast everybody. And there were a few other guys in Ghoul School, like comics.
Right.
Not a comics. Paul Vanier.
Right.
Eddie Gambino.
Right.
So that's how he got those guys. I'll never forget one quick story. Mm-hmm. I was setting up equipment in the hallway of Joe Franklin's office in some, you know, really run-down office building, right, probably on 9th Avenue or something. And I'm in the hallway because his office was so small,
right,
and so packed with stuff.
Cluttered, right.
That the crew was outside with just the lens pointing in. So I'm on the ground, like, getting equipment, and, like, I'm looking down. Like, I'm low, so I'm, like, eye level.
Yeah.
And running towards me is like this huge roach.
Oh.
Like making, almost in my mind, making noise. And my bit of advice, if anyone listening to this interview, what you can get out of it is this very simple advice. If you're in New York and you're in Port Authority or a bus terminal, don't put your bags down. I have seen live rats and roaches in Port Authority waiting for a bus in the middle of the day.
Oh.
God. So don't put your bags on the ground. Just put them on your shoulder.
Especially with all the clutter in Franklin's office. I've seen pictures. It's like, wow.
Incredible.
I was just going to say that personally, I've been a fan of Franklin's campy late night talk show since my early teens because it was so low rent and he was so out of touch with contemporary culture. And yet he'd occasionally score an actual on the rise or independent actor, director, musician. Like he had the Jake Isles band on. He had Al Adamson. And it was always hilarious. And actually in your film, it was hilarious and surreal to watch him react in near horror as Jackie was reading those bad, dirty jokes off a scrap of paper at him in his cluttered office while delivering the occasional snide put-down back at Jackie, which Jackie seemed entirely oblivious to. So the whole scene was really amusing.
It was all ad-lib. I remember it so vividly. Jackie came in. Joe was there like a fixture in his chair.
Right.
And it was all just ad-lib, you know, and Jackie was pounding out the jokes, and Joe was just like responding off the top of his head.
In terms of the basement now, there's two areas I want to touch on. One being your actual story in relation to the J.R. Bookwalter connection and the issue with the Super 8 filming. And the second being the very recent restoration and release of the film, which had been unreleased from the time of filming until now. Give us the inside scoop on this.
The Basement is a Super 8 feature film. It was produced and shot 6 months before Ghoul School.
Right.
So Ghoul School was shot in January of 1990. Basement was shot in May of 1989. Tim O'Rah was negotiating with Camp Video, which was a West Coast company at the time, to produce a feature film. And of course, I mean, nothing much has changed in independent filmmaking. Very rarely will someone give you money. So Camp or any other label back then was like, great, you know, make the movie and we'll look at it.
Right.
So Tim and his friend Kathleen, who became his wife, came up with the cash for The Basement. And for whatever reason, I don't know, and I'm horrified to this day, they wanted to shoot it on Super 8. And I think it was because of the success of J.R. Bookwalter's The Dead Next Door.
Yes.
J.R. Bookwalter is an Ohio-based filmmaker. He, in like 85 or 86, decided to make a zombie film on Super 8. And back then, you know, zombie films were not fashionable.
No.
I mean,
they were kind of rare at the point.
They were rare at that point. And he shot a zombie film on Super 8. It was covered in Fangoria in this big spread. Of course, Tim O'Rah into horror. By the way, Tim, he wears a horror t-shirt every day. Every day it's a different horror t-shirt.
Wow.
You name it. Evil Dead, you know. I mean, you name it. He's a horror t-shirt guy. He must have 100 of them. He read Fangoria, and he knew about Tim Ritter and Killing Spree. He knew about, you know, J.R. Bookwalter and The Dead Next Door. Right. So he contacted J.R. Bookwalter.
Okay.
You know, he did his Tim O'Rah magic. You know, if he has Wes Craven's number, he's going to make friends with J.R. Bookwalter.
Right.
So I think we took a ride out to Ohio to go see J.R. Almost positive we did. Maybe a few times. And they got to chatting. And before you know it, Tim is going to borrow J.R.'s Super 8 camera to shoot The Basement. And I shot Super 8 for home movies at home and, you know, my friends on vacation goofing around. Yeah, understand, I was a serious filmmaker. So I was, you know, for me, you're going to shoot on minimum 16mm.
Right.
Because it gives you more control in the sense that the cameras are more professional.
Right.
And there are real lenses as opposed to these, I mean, sort of like a consumer camcorder versus a professional camera these days. So I got the camera, and of course I knew everything back then. So I, you know, shot the film, and JR warned me that if you're going to shoot with it, make sure you put it in A, auto.
Right.
And don't try to override it to try to do exposures and stuff. Like, of course, I ignored him, which is why much of The Basement was very dark.
Yes.
Which is why The Basement got shelved, and Tim moved on in Ghoul School, which is an amazing feat in itself because if you look at the timeline, we shot The Basement in May.
Right.
And by July, August, Tim was already in pre-production on Ghoul School, which was shot that January. So it's an amazing amount of stuff was compressed in a very small period of time.
Right.
Of course, once again, I was horrified. Horrified that I had to shoot Super 8. Horrified that the footage was black. And horrified and shocked and surprised that Tim talked to me.
Yeah.
You know.
You also had some promo material on there where people had interviewed you and said, oh, look, here, we're making The Basement, and then it never came out.
There was, are you talking about the news piece?
Yes.
The local news channel came down and did a whole story on us. I'm here in Jefferson, New Jersey, where a film crew is producing a horror film here in Jefferson County. And then they interviewed everybody.
Right.
And, Tim is a very loyal guy. You know, I really do believe that he's a loyal guy. And I remember being very scared making Ghoul School because I had the jitters because I did such a shitty job on The Basement. And the Ghoul School was produced by David Dakota.
Right.
So there was, like, real money there. Right. Not that I got any of it. Got eaten up with the budget. But I had the jitters because, more jitters than I have now drinking this coffee in a can. I had the jitters because I thought, oh, my God, because they FedEx the film out at night to Hollywood. Right. Big time, right?
Yeah.
And I thought I'd be fired. Like, fire that guy. I thought the call would come and be like, fire that guy on the camera. Tim, is the footage okay? And Tim was just so mellow. I was like, yeah, the footage is great. Okay, next shot.
You were also involved with Meadowlands Showcase, examples of which appear on both the Ghoul School and Basement DVDs. Who was that guy that kept playing the ghoul in the two Halloween episodes?
Oh, Meadowlands Showcase. Meadowlands Showcase was a cable, not cable access, a regional cable show. See, my snootiness still comes through. Does not know. I never produced cable access. John Fedeli and I produced Meadowlands Showcase for 3-4 years, and it was like artists, performers, short films, a hodgepodge of creative stuff. In a half an hour. And, of course, Tim O'Raw, you know, being our friend, he would come up with these ideas. Like, let's do a wraparound show.
Right.
You know, a horror host, yada, yada. So the horror host, David Weber.
Okay.
And the character was Marim. The character was Angus. Maybe it was Angus.
Angus. That was Angus. It. It was Angus.
David was in The Basement.
Right.
And he was a horror host twice on Meadowlands Showcase.
Right.
And those episodes of Meadowlands Showcase were produced, like, the same month we were in production on either Ghoul School or The Basement. So that's why if you look at those Meadowlands Showcase episodes, you'll see a lot of crossover.
Yeah, it seemed like a very strange show, and I'm sorry that I missed it in its original incarnation. I actually enjoy watching these sort
of. Were you in that area?
Yeah.
You had Comcast?
We had Cablevision.
Okay, occasionally. Yeah, you know, it was on like 4:30 in the afternoon on Cablevision.
Okay.
You know, when no one's home.
Right. Did you have any trouble securing the rights to include the Cramps video on the DVD? I'm a huge fan of that band from the way back, and they pretty much got me both in the classic rockabilly and the something weird cinema milieu.
I love the Cramps. I love the Cramps. I love the Cramps. I love the Cramps.
Amen.
I saw Garbage Man video before MTV on a USA Network-produced show called Video Concert Hall.
Right.
You recall that? Remember?
I remember a lot of early shows.
Early.
Like Radio 1990.
Yeah.
And the things they did on HBO and interstitials.
Yeah.
And
they would play Garbage Man. And when I heard that, I had heard nothing like that in my life. I ran down to the record store and bought the Cramps. I believe it's called Songs the Lord Taught Us.
Yes.
So that was early 1980s. So by the time I was producing Meadowlands Showcase, I called, I believe it was IRS Records.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that. I called up IRS Records and I said, my name is Michael Rosso. I'm producing a show, and I'd like the broadcast rights to put the Cramps video as a promotion in this piece. They sent me the master tape. They sent me the paperwork. You know, cool. I mean, it's just promotion, really.
Awesome. So I'm guessing that your first move after the Tim O'Raw movies and starting up EI at Audiovision was starting a production on the Seduction Cinema line, because your earliest titles seemed to start around 1998 with your building something of an empire around Darian Kane, and more specifically, The Lovely Misty Monday and Short Order thereafter. How did you find Misty? Was this a deliberate strategy?
A lot of the sort of beginnings of was like, you know, an explosion in the lab. You know, some scientist is trying to create something and it explodes, but he created something else instead.
Right.
But, you know, so by 1998, we started carving out labels for our studio. I mean, the company was EI Independent Cinema.
Right.
EI Independent Cinema is really the company, and we needed sort of to break out the various studios so that they could be marketed. properly. So Seduction Cinema, Shock-O-Rama Cinema. We started actually making independent films. We started making films on a regular basis, and Seduction Cinema happened by accident.
Right.
We produced two movies, Caress of the Vampire and Vampire Seduction with Tina Krause.
Right.
And with the idea of, hey, we're going to put them out on VHS, but it gives us an opportunity to go to the Chiller Theater show. You know, we were going to forever, Kevin Clement's Chiller Theater, and
right.
we could bring the girls with us and sell some movies. And back then, you can go to Chiller, and you could have the cast there, and you could sell 100 VHS tapes.
Yeah.
And that's pretty good. I mean, for us, back then, just starting out.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. We did it, and we had no idea that there was going to be any success there. Darian Kane was pretty much the first Seduction Cinema star, cast her through a casting agent.
Right.
Tina Krause should have been, but she didn't want to do the movies.
Ooh.
She didn't care, like, she didn't care for the kind of lesbian vampire type
right.
content, and that's cool. I mean, I'm sorry she didn't, because
right.
I think, and still think, she's fantastic.
Yeah.
Misty Monday, simply... was William Hellfire's girlfriend.
Wow.
She was young, cute, talented, could play the guitar, and we cast her, maybe it was Gladiator, Eroticus, or one of those early movies, not in a starring role.
Right.
And she really, the camera loves her, and she really kind of popped off the screen. She is the exact opposite of what people think of as a Seduction Cinema star, which to me probably made it work.
Right. I was going to say, she's unusually fresh-faced and natural in a genre that's predominantly populated by, you know, tattooed, pierced, surgically enhanced kind of women.
Yeah.
And at least by the time she gets to the Brett Piper films and Polonius, Splatter Beach, things like that, she's actually a fairly good actress.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, no, she's very talented.
Yeah. So how did you get hooked up with Brett Piper? The better part of his work after the trio films that finally got released in the form of Raiders of the Living Dead seems to have taken place under the auspices of your Shock-O-Rama label.
There was time in the late 90s when we were just starting out and things were really starting to roll.
Right.
And I used to have a habit of calling people really late. Like 11, 12, you know, midnight, I'd call people. Like, I don't know. I guess I could attribute it to just being young. I remember the first time I called Brett. I got his number from I don't know who. It was one of the other guys. It might have been like Kevin Lindemuth or another filmmaker. I'm like, it's Brett Piper. And he had finished Drainiac.
Right.
And I phoned Brett at an ungodly hour to say hi, to introduce myself.
Right.
And Brett didn't think anything of it, you know, which I'm really glad. Because I know if people call me after 10, it's like, don't.
I try not to.
Yeah. Called Brett and introduced myself. Hey, you know, my name's Mike Rosso. I have this company, yada, yada. And, you know, we were considering putting out Drainiac, and he had a few offers. I always like to talk realistically to filmmakers. I'm not like a salesman. I don't want to sell someone on a promise that I can't deliver.
Right.
You know, I'm always of the cautious, like, if you sign our film to us, we're going to do the best job possible, but I can't promise. Because, you know, if you're a filmmaker, you want your movie to be signed to a label that's going to get into Blockbuster.
Right.
Especially back then.
Right.
We didn't sign Drainiac, but I knew Brett Piper, and... By the time early 2000s, 2002 or 3, an actor by the name of Kevin Shinnick was working at EI, and he was a really big Brett fan, and he really helped push. He's like, because we were producing at the time, and he's like, should get Brett Piper in here to make some movies. And it went by, and things were so incredibly busy, like crazy busy, with live productions going on at the same time, and Kevin always kept nudging, like, call Brett, you know, he's like, I'll get him on the phone.
Right.
And I was like, okay, great, get him on the phone. So I remember the first Brett Piper movie, Screaming Dead, before, you know, it was really sort of like, I'm glad someone nudged that, because I don't think that it would have ever happened because I was so busy. So
right.
It was as simple as, called Brett, why don't you come down for a meeting,
right.
A pitch meeting, and he came down, and then he was here for like 4 or 5 years. He moved to Butler.
Right.
So it started with Screaming Dead, and he did Screaming Dead, Bite Me, Shock-O-Rama, Bacterium. I don't know if I'm leaving one out. Oh, we picked up Drainiac.
Okay.
That's how the Brett Piper relationship started.
Yeah, for those who don't know Brett Piper, his work's an interesting mix of old-school monster movie special effects, like the old famous monsters, Ray Harryhausen types, and more modern stylings. And I was going to say, I particularly enjoyed Screaming Dead. And the sequence in Shock-O-Rama with Misty and the zombie was really, that stood out too. So how did you get Allison Whitney, who's best known for the Weekly Kids promotional web show Nintendo Week, to star in Brett's Bacterium, and she later go on to Brett and Mark Polonia's excellent Muckman? It seems like a bit of a jump from this kid show thing to sci-fi horror, complete with a sort of a nude scene.
Yes, I don't think that Allison was doing the kids show then.
Oh, really? Okay.
Brett Piper, very comprehensive. Brett had his own little production office. Brett had his own desk, you know, his own area, his own file cabinet, and in that file cabinet were probably hundreds of headshots.
Right.
So Brett would put the word out, and he would get, I mean, these headshots that would show up, incredible amount of headshots.
Yeah.
So he weed through them and do like a little casting call. That's how he hired her.
Alternative Cinema, your catalog and distribution site. I understand you acquired this from J.R. Bookwalter, who'd also given you his Super 8 camera from the next door for use in the basement. What was the connection with J.R. since he seems to keep reappearing in your story?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say, J.R., I gave you your camera back. I don't have your camera. You have your camera. Although I do think I have one of your Lowell Totalites. Well, early on, as I mentioned, how we met J.R.,
right.
You know, we were all kind of friendly. You know, I mean, I would hop in my buggy, and it must be attributed to being young, because now I don't want to hop in my car to, like, go do my laundry. I used to think nothing of hopping in my car to go see JR, and he's, like, what, 7-8 hours away in Ohio?
Yeah.
You know, nothing. So I was really driving this whole, you know, distribution thing, and for a few films, we actually distributed a few of JR's films, The Sandman
right. And
Polymorph. And, of course, when he was shooting, myself and some friends, Pete Jackalone, we were invited to JR's set.
Right.
So we were kind of friendly, and he would come out. We would do the horror conventions together. We'd do Fangoria. It was just like a little group, and we talked frequently. JR was producing Alternative Cinema magazine. Then he decided to move to California.
Okay.
And when JR decided to move to California, he wanted to jettison Alternative Cinema magazine. Coast to coast distribution.
Yeah, I remember.
So when he moved to California, he sold Alternative Cinema to me. I'm glad it's still around. Yeah.
I was going to say, I should point out to the listeners that Alternative is not the only place to get Pop Cinema titles. They're rarely available at major online retailers like Amazon, Deep Discount, DVD Universe, so on. But you obviously have a more complete catalog than any of those sources carry at any given time.
You listen to Third Eye Cinema. Tonight we're interviewing Mike Rasso of EI Entertainment, now known as Pop Cinema. Coming up next, we'll be talking to Jill Sarno and Nick Phillips, only here in Third Eye Cinema.
Your retro seduction cinema line, which is one of my major areas of interest. I believe you scored something of an exclusive deal with the great Joe Sarno for restoration and release of a number of his classic titles, right?
Yes. I love Joe Sarno. Joe Sarno reminded me of like a grandfather who lived in a different state. You know, I would see him frequently. He passed away last year, sadly, and I really miss him. But that's how it all kind of began, because back in the late 1990s, we achieved amazing success with our seduction cinema line. They were carried coast to coast. And back then, and I don't know if I could attribute it to the fact that President Clinton like would play a saxophone on the Tonight Show, or things were very loose in this country.
That's true.
It's just loose. Like everything was just cool, you know? Like presidents getting blowjobs. It's like, you know, it's no big deal. So you'd walk into Best Buy and you'd buy Vampire Seduction,
right.
You know, in special interest section.
Yes.
So it'd be like religious videos, Seduction Cinema.
Right.
And then next to that would be like CKY and all those like backyard brawls.
Yes.
You know, so it was the strangest thing. If you put something as I guess, attractive on the shelf of a major store at a time when people were buying so many discs,
right.
People started buying them. So we had all this success, and I guess seeing these videos in stores, in so many stores, producers started seeing that and investigating, like, oh, who the heck are these guys? They're everywhere. So I got a call from Chris Niebe, who produced three Joe Sarno films in Germany with Joe in 1973.
Right.
And the same thing happened with Sam Sherman, Independent International Pictures. Sadly, we never distributed Dracula vs. Frankenstein.
Yeah.
But we distributed many of Sam's movies. Folks started to notice that, who are these guys and what are they doing? Once we started licensing Joe Sarno films, which I really didn't know much about, Chris said to me on the phone, he's like, have you heard of Joe Sarno? I'm like, no. Have you heard of Inga? I'm like, I think so. Early internet, I dialed up my modem, AOL.
Wow, I remember those days.
You know, did a little, whatever it was. I don't know if Google was around back then. It might have been a Yahoo search.
Yahoo, yeah.
There might have been an early IMDb back then. And I saw, Joe Sarno. He sent us some screeners. We already had Seduction Cinema, so it seemed a natural progression to be like, oh, okay, wow. These are, first of all, they're good films. The Joe Sarno films, they're really good films. They're high and above anything we were producing. I'm like, these are good films. So we licensed those first three. And then Sam Sherman contacted me and said, I own some Joe Sarno films. And he owned Inga, Seduction of Inga, Swedish Wildcats. We met Sam. And then because now I had so many Joe Sarno films,
right,
I went and met Joe Sarno because we started recording commentary tracks. So that's how that began. And that blossomed from there, because once that happened, then somehow we were in touch with Nick Phillips.
Right.
Who was an obscure filmmaker from the 60s.
Right.
He didn't have distribution as broad and wide as the Joe Sarno films. He was a sort of old-fashioned that he would make a movie and then film under his arm, go to New York, play it, take his film back, go to another theater, play it. So that's how that all exploded, the retro seduction, and kind of went from there.
It's kind of hard to explain what makes a Sarno film so different from your typical softcore effort, but there is a clear and obvious difference. They're darker with some moral undertones, consequences to characters' actions. But trying to say that's it gives a very wrong impression. It's not like we're saying Catholic guilt is great or something, but there's a depth to a Sarno film that's quite unique in the annals of softcore. Tell me about Joe as you knew him and about his wife Peggy as well, as she was such a major force in his films, both on and off screen.
In the mid-1960s, theater owners were looking for movies that they could get big box office with, but not major films. So they started importing like softcore sex movies.
Right.
And many people think Joe Sarno is Swedish. He's not. He's a New Yorker. He was hired to go to Sweden to make a movie because they wanted to import it as a foreign film.
Right.
Back then, the laws were very gray about what is pornographic. So you can get away with a black and white softcore movie, and people would flock to them because there's nothing else like it. Pornography was strictly under the table at that point.
Right.
You couldn't just go and rent a porno. It was illegal. You get arrested.
Right.
It just so happens that Joe is an excellent storyteller.
Yeah.
And he's not interested in just churning out a piece of crap. Joe puts 110% into his movies, and he writes it from the perspective of the story.
Right.
Not just having, you know, a 7-minute sex film and then, you know, he cares.
Yeah.
And that's really at the heart of it. Joe actually cares about his characters. He works with his actors, which is unheard of because the theatrical promoters don't care.
They don't. It's true.
They don't care. They don't watch the movies. They just want to know what the box office is. So whether Joe put the effort in or didn't put the effort in, here's your budget, here's your time frame, deliver us our movie.
Right.
So Joe was an artist.
I believe, other than Moonlighting Wives, that the better part of your releases of Sarno films were situated firmly in his late 60s Swedish period and his early to mid-70s period, where he worked with the amazing Mary Mendham, also known as Rebecca Brook, star of, as you mentioned, Radley Metzger's incredible The Image. She really has quite a screen presence. Not only is she beautiful clothed or not, but she has an intensity and utter fearlessness about exploring the extremes of sexuality that's quite rare, particularly in mainstream cinema. I mean, we're not talking about cheesy, billowing curtains and lit candles and that kind of 90s thing like 9 1/2 Weeks or Zalman King. We're talking about really pushing the envelope, breaking boundaries, and reaching for the limits. And again, this isn't hardcore. We're talking mainstream softcore cinema here. I particularly liked Confessions of a Young American Housewife and Laura's Toys from the Sarno releases you put out. So whatever happened to Misty? You promoted that film in trailers and your catalog inserts, but it never actually appeared. Are there plans to release it or to re-release Sarno's Seduction of Inga, which I unfortunately missed the first time around and now is commanding irrational amounts of money online?
Is that true?
Yeah.
Wow. The film Misty, it's a 1976 film, and it's from that era of Joe Sarno's softcore. Sort of fits in with Confessions of a Young American Housewife, Laura's Toys, their ensemble casts. You'll see
right.
the same cast in it. The amount of work involved with actually releasing the film is staggering. First and foremost, who owns the film?
Right.
In the case of Joe Sarno, most of those relationships are easy because if Joe didn't personally own the film, then he knew who did.
Right.
If a film is not in the public domain, if there's a copyright notice on a film, then someone owns it. So the task is, of course, to track down who owns the film. And in the case of Misty, you don't do all the work of getting a film prepped for release.
Right.
And then track down the copyright.
Oh, okay.
You do one first, but I was so confident that everything would work out, only to discover that the copyright, not only is the copyright valid on Misty, but the copyright has been renewed every time that the renewal period is up.
Okay.
So the film is owned by a company and a gentleman, and that gentleman will not do a deal. And it's that simple.
Okay.
It's that simple. That film is copywritten. And we have not been able to secure the rights.
And it was just odd because you had the trailers on several releases and then, you know, it just never showed.
Not only do I have the trailer, I have the DVD is done.
Wow.
DVD is done and the film was culled from a variety of sources.
Right.
Because that's the problem also. For example, I worked with the producer of Daddy Darling.
Right.
And I really dig in deep when I get involved with these films. Daddy Darling, I re-up the copyright.
Right.
Find it. You find the copyright's expired. What do you got to do? You got to protect your film. Okay. Find it. Find the filmmaker. Cut a deal. Revitalize that copyright. Release your movie.
Right.
So that's what I did with Daddy Darling. And that worked out great. But the producer of Daddy Darling didn't have the film Daddy Darling.
Okay.
And that happens all the time.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I own the movie, but I don't have the movie. You know, I have a VHS.
Right.
So you have to track down from collectors prints.
Right.
And then cull together the best possible print to
right.
release the film. It's a job unto itself, and for a period of time in my career, I was devoting almost all my time to retro seduction cinema, and it
right.
probably shows by the releases.
It does. They're really quality releases.
Yeah.
And what about Seduction of Inga? Because that went out of print, and like I said, it's never come back.
Oh, Seduction of Inga is owned by Retro Seduction, and really it's just a matter of that it went out of print. And now it's a matter of, and then we've been chatting about this for a year, of re-releasing Inga and Seduction of Inga in a collector's edition,
right.
and also make it available for streaming.
So do you think that's going to happen anytime soon?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, good. Because I had actually, at the Chiller Show, like you mentioned, I had talked to someone a year ago, one of your representatives, and they said, oh, that'll be coming out soon, just like you mentioned, with Inga. And then the next time I went to Chiller, I talked to somebody else, and they said, oh, no, that's not happening. Just get it on eBay.
So oh, yeah.
I wasn't
yeah.
sure what the deal is.
Well, it's difficult these days to re-release a title that's already been released, because
right.
there's who's going to buy it? A lot of collectors own it already.
Right.
And when we released those, I guess it was 2002, 2003, I mean, they were really, really popular.
Right.
I mean, Inga is a classic film, and as is the sequel, Seduction of Inga.
Right.
And I'm very fond of those releases. We got an interview with Marie Lilienthal.
Right.
You know, Inga herself, and they were great, great productions. So, yeah, hold tight. I would guess that the Joe Sarno Library will start. You'll start seeing it.
But will it come out on DVD again or just on streaming?
We'll have it available on DVD.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Very much looking forward to that personally.
Oh, good.
So tell us about Nick Phillips, as you mentioned before. You released a few of his very interesting takes on the horror film, Criminally Insane, also known as Crazy Fat Apple, and Satan's Black Wedding, plus a number of his classic softcore titles from the late 60s and early 70s. How did you get involved with Nick? He seems like a very different personality than Sarno, though their films have this sort of similar grim tone.
It's a scenario with Nick Phillips as the Sarno scenario. We got a call, and I didn't know anything about Nick's films. He sent a bunch of screeners on VHS, and I'm really glad that we hooked up because his films, first of all, they were never seen on VHS.
Right.
And secondly, Nick has his own unique imprint style as well.
Yeah.
Pleasures of a Woman, I think, is probably my favorite because he used sync sound.
Right.
Nick is a very economical filmmaker, very smart filmmaker, and he produces things very inexpensively. And the art of Nick's film is secondary to getting the film done. Very different than Joe Sarno.
Right.
But what you realize is that once you look at all of Nick Phillips' movies, is that despite the fact that he was just throwing these films together, and I mean that in a loving way, I mean all sorts of tricks. Like if you need a location, you go to a real estate office, you find an empty house, you tell the real estate person, oh, I'd like to look at the house again. You get the keys, and you go in the house and shoot over the weekend, and
wow.
you give the keys back on Monday.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, all sorts of really ingenious, but I mean, who would think?
No, it's crazy, but I can see it. It works.
Lack of sync sound. Doris Wishman did that too. Lack of sync sound, either for not wanting to deal with it, not feeling it's important. But through all sort of some ineptness is this beauty of a style that is truly Nick Phillips, and I would call him an artist.
Yeah, because it does come out. That's why I mentioned him specifically.
Unique. Very unique, those films.
So tell me about your rediscovery and restoration, as you mentioned, of the great Doris Wishman's first film, Hideout in the Sun. That film was something of a holy grail among Wishman devotees for decades. So how did you stumble on such a nice print of this one?
Joe Sarno's Inga was playing at the New York Underground Film Festival in 2002, and I got a call from Doris Wishman biographer Michael Bowen. Michael's also a film historian, and he called me because he wanted to know, hey, do you have a print of Inga? Because they're screening this battered print. So he called me because of that. I went to the festival, I met Michael, and in meeting and talking to Michael and him seeing what I'm doing with Joe Sarno, he relayed to me that he is Doris Wishman's biographer. And I think at that time, maybe she just passed away around that time, and that he had a few Doris Wishman films and would I like to release them. So Hideout in the Sun, amazing movie. Just an amazing film, should be seen by everybody. It's kind of crazy. It's really kind of psychotronic, I would call it.
It really is. I mean, even if you don't like Wishman films, this would be the one to check out. There's something special about it.
So back then, of course, I would go all out, really. It was just like, there was no question, get the film. This is the film that was in Doris Wishman's closet on the top shelf of her closet. No one knew it was there. And we did a whole high-definition restoration of it.
Right.
And I think on the DVD is like what you call balls out.
Yeah, you have two discs on it.
You have like the letterbox version and the original 4x3,
right,
which is the actual preferred format. Yeah, that was awesome. Really an awesome release.
It really is the best of her nudie cutie period. And for those who don't know, it's a strange mix of a heist film and a nudist camp film that you really have to see to believe. And, as a Wishman devotee, we have to say we're forever in your debt for this one. You also put out a few Between the Cracks, Something Weird style titles, which I very much enjoyed. The Sexperts with Audrey Campbell of Olga Film fame and The Sexploiters. And there were also numerous Rene Bond and Ashiet Degar films you've been responsible for getting out there. As a fan of Bond and a good friend of somebody who's a big fan of Degar, again, the collective thanks to the viewing public for your efforts in this regard. There were also a few odd, if much appreciated, releases of films by Jesus Franco in his latter period, Tender Flesh and Lust for Frankenstein, Al Adamson, Nurse Sherry being a particular favorite, some Women in Prison films, including one much appreciated one from Bruno Mattei, who stars one of my favorite actresses, Laura Emanuel Gemser, and the best of the amusing, if gruesome, Andre Schnatz and Todd Sheets films. Was there any overall game plan here, or was it more of like, hey, I like this one, it's available, let's go for it?
Many times we get approached because of the fact that we're so prolific. So we get approached many times, and I am very much a fan and believe in ensemble. Once I started working with Joe Sarno, for example, I want really all of Joe Sarno's movies because I want them to be all here in a group, which makes it attractive to a fan as well.
Right.
When I started putting out Nick Phillips movies, I knew who Ushi was, but I didn't know exactly who she was.
Right.
Once you find she is in so many films, then for me, I'm excited about getting more Ushi Dygard films so we could have our own Ushi section.
Right.
Same thing with Rene Bond. Rene Bond was in Le Chic.
Right.
And I didn't know that Rene Bond was in so many films.
Yes.
So many films, and many of them never seen before. And if they're out, they're not even out illegally, but they're out in like some small catalogs.
Right.
Like they're not really done right, so to speak.
Right.
So I felt that my goal is always, and I'm always attracted to, bringing groups together. This way, in our AC catalog, for example, we could have sort of nice sections.
Right.
Ushi Dygard section, Rene Bond section, and offer a variety of different films from these, these stars.
Right.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Tonight's guest is Mike Rasso with EI Entertainment, now known as Pop Cinema. Coming up next, Camp Motion Pictures and 80 Shot on Video Cinema. I'm here on Third Eye Cinema. We'll be right back.
to, for me, the real meat of the matter, Camp Motion Pictures.
Oh, no.
Tell us about your aims here and how you get started and become the number one go-to source for 80s SOV shot and video cinema.
Camp Motion Pictures sprung to life only because of Gary P. Cohen. Gary, not going to surprise you, called us up. Hey, I'm in New Jersey. My name is Gary Cohen. I did Video Violence. I want you guys to put out my picture. Gary, I love Gary. Yeah. Gary is a wonderful guy. We have the same sensibilities. It's not about the money. The same sensibilities. Because sometimes I want to acquire a movie, and it's just a matter of, you know, well, you have to have this money.
Right.
And it's not about the money. For me, it's as a gatekeeper of so many films, it's about where is your film, how is it being represented, and how is it being preserved.
Right.
So Gary, in the mid-2000s, called us. He met with Jeffrey, and at first didn't even meet with me. And Jeff was like, oh, you know, Gary Cohen wants to do a deal. I'm like,
Right.
Because we were really Shockorama focused in the mid-2000s.
Yes.
Shockorama focused. We were doing a new film with Joe Sarno.
Right.
This Camp Motion Pictures was barely a thought back then. And Gary was very persistent, and I'm glad he was. I'll sell it to you. And I won't say how low he sold this to us for, but he made us an offer we could not refuse. And I just shrugged my shoulders to Jeff because I was really not that involved at that point. I was like, great.
Right.
I mean, I want to acquire films. I was sort of familiar with the film. I'm always, always confident that bringing a film to us, we have a library of films.
Right.
I go through great expense to keep our films properly stored. Like, it's great. It's going to be a great home for them. Great. Do the deal. Gary comes over. I might have been around at this time. I might have been in the office. Gary comes over with two huge boxes.
Right.
Big boxes. Big square heavy boxes with all sorts of videotapes in it. VHS tapes, 3/4 inch U-matic Sony tapes, mini tapes. We put them in our fax closet.
Right.
Fax closet, which is almost the same size of the room of the first office I moved into. Our own fax closet. And there it sat. And it seems longer, but it probably wasn't. We probably did that deal in 2005.
Right.
And I didn't take a peek in that box till 2007.
Wow.
And Gary was cool enough to sort of like do the deal, and that was it. Because Gary is the producer-director of Plays in the Park
right. In
Middlesex County here in New Jersey. And he's a busy guy.
Yeah.
He just wanted to, you know, he's like, I want to get these out on DVD. Can you do a poster?
Right.
You know, he's very enthusiastic and just wants to see the movies come out.
Yeah.
In 2007, because you have the DVD business started imploding by 2000, as early as 2005.
Yeah.
Because the ground under us started shaking very early of the indication of things to come, and that is stores going out of business.
Yes.
When Tower Video failed, that was the first indication, beginning of the end. So at that time, I thought, you know, I really want to start, I want to do something else. You know, I want to do something different. Video Violence was the first, I don't know if I was walking and a tape fell off the shelf, hit me on the head. But something, you know, like an apple fell on my head. And I thought, oh, you know, because Gary brought over all these elaborate ad sheets and all these publications and sales material, retail stuff from the 80s when Video Violence was first released on Camp Video.
Right.
And I looked at it, and I'm like, wow, this camp stuff's really cool. You know, it's really, really cool. So I hired a lawyer. I researched the whole Camp Video was going on. Is that name available? What's going on Camp Video? Are they around? Yada, yada, so and so forth. So I launched Camp Motion Pictures.
Right.
The reason I launched Camp Motion Pictures is I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to do something different with different national distribution partners because the ground was, I felt tremors in the ground under me, which told me that if a larger distribution partner went out of business, they might suck me in with them.
Right.
You know, they'll just pull me right down with them, and I can't let that happen.
Right.
You know, I can't. So I decided to start Camp Motion Pictures as a separate entity and start researching and looking into these sort of early 1980s releases. And we had a few already. We had Beauty Queen Butcher,
right,
which was sitting on our shelf, which was never released. The Polonia Brothers.
Right.
With their splatter farm. Some of the group was already there, and if it wasn't there, it was easily accessible.
Right.
So that's how we launched Camp Motion Pictures, and with Gary's film, Video Violence and Video Violence 2, that was in that box was everything he ever shot. So that film I'm really proud of, And I'd like to thank Joe Kolbeck, who was very excited about that kind of stuff.
Right.
And Joe's an editor. And that movie, film is remastered from its original camera tapes.
Wow.
So that Video Violence and Video Violence 2 have never looked as good. They didn't look as good when they were first released on VHS.
Yeah, I'm actually I don't want to say of the generation that's younger because it's not really true, but when those were out in the video stores, I just ignored them. I only discovered it when you started putting them out on DVD.
Oh, no kidding.
And I was like, wow, these are good. And I went through another one and another one, and now I'm a fan.
You know, right now in 2012, there's like an explosion of fans who are like, it used to be only a few years ago you could find a few mom-and-pop video stores.
Right.
And you still find those old big boxes on
the
shelves.
Exactly, right.
But now that's all extinguished. Like,
totally gone.
They're all gone. So fans are clamoring to find those big boxes and trading, have trade groups.
Yes, I've seen that.
And I understand that these go for high tickets on eBay,
the
big boxes. And it's exciting. It's exciting now, Camp Motion Pictures, that people are, you know, really excited about this stuff. And now I think there's enough time. Because back in the 90s, it was too close to it.
Exactly. Back then, I was like, well, okay, you see this stuff everywhere, who cares? But
Now
it's like, wow, this is really special. You know, it's very different from everything else that's out there. So if you like it, you really get into it hard.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
All right. Perhaps, obviously, you put out your two films with Tim O'Raw, but you also gave us, as you had mentioned, both films from John McBride, Cannibal Camp Out, Woodchipper Massacre, two films from the Polonia Brothers, their first national release, Splatter Farm, plus the amusing Splatter Beach with Aaron Brown, who was the former Mr. Monday, Tim Murder's Killing Spree, the amusingly off-kilter Jill Zerberg effort, Beauty Queen Butcher, and three from Gary Cohen, both Video Violence films and The Long Lost Captives, all three of which appear alongside The Basement and Cannibal Camp Out without the original release's extras on that big box release of The Basement that you just put out, which is really something essential for people into these things. So what was the impetus for actually including a VHS of The Basement in that box? As you were kind of mentioning already, are today's kids really that nostalgic for what was ultimately an ephemeral and flawed medium, VHS?
Paige Davis runs my home entertainment company.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say it was her idea because big box was in the works for quite a while. And Paige, who runs the department, felt that in this day and age, if you're going to release something, you have to release something that's special.
True.
And if you're going to release something, what would make someone want to buy it so that even if they're streaming it illegally online, that they want to buy it?
Right.
And my companies have always been behind the booklets and really packing the DVD releases, mostly because of me as a fan going to buy a DVD. I never forget, I bought when Night of the Living Dead was remastered the first time.
Right.
I bought the DVD, opened it up. Oh, my God. Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, there's nothing in there.
Nothing. There's no booklet. And it's like, I felt like, oh, my God, this is like, you know, this one of my favorite films, my top 10 film list. I want there to be something more.
Exactly. Right.
So from a fan perspective, we feel we want to give something special to our customer. And the idea of completing The Basement, most of the time it was sitting on a shelf in its 21-year history.
Right.
You know, we go from shelf to shelf. The fact that it was all actually found is amazing. But there was really never any talk of remastering it or finishing it because it was just such a task.
Right.
But then all of a sudden, in like 2008, 2009, there was this interest in this 1980s, you know, shot on video, even though it was shot on bad Super 8. There's this great interest. All at once, it seemed like, oh, my God, I shot a movie in the 1980s that was never released.
Right.
Ever. And we thought, like, ding, like, oh, my God, we could put it out in a big box to celebrate the time.
Right.
That's how that began. And, you know, 2 years later, it became a reality only because The Basement had to be actually created.
Right.
From whatever was left in 1989.
Right.
And it seemed like a great idea, and it couldn't be just one film. It had to be like an amazing box.
Right.
And I'm so proud of it.
But I was talking about the inclusion of the VHS tape itself in there.
Oh!
So, because, you know, VHS, as great as it was in its day, it's really kind of, you watch older tapes and they're falling apart, the magnetic heads or whatever story.
Yeah.
Separating, the sound gets bad, the picture gets pixelated, you get tracking lines. So I was wondering, is there really clamoring for this now in this market?
Yes. I would say yes. I would say that many of the people I spoke to that bought The Basement, they watched the VHS first.
Really?
Yes.
Because I kept this, like, okay, well, this is cute, you know, there it is, but I didn't touch it, I watched the DVD version.
There are groups of fans around the country now who get together and have VHS screening parties.
Wow.
they'll buy or, you know, find an old VHS copy of a movie from the actual original, and they sit around and they watch VHS.
Wow.
It's a whole reverse. I mean, you think about in today's day and age, people go to Best Buy to buy their widescreen.
Right.
Or to improve and buy their next widescreen.
Right.
Because they want to watch football in high definition. Crisp, clear, like crystal clear.
I guess it's the same thing as people that are getting into picking up 8-tracks.
Yes.
I was around for 8-tracks. I remember you'd be listening to a song, and it would stop in the middle, click, click,
yep.
And then it would pick up on the other side.
Yeah.
And it was silly, but, you know, it's nostalgic if you were there. But I think kids nowadays are like, you actually have 8-track collectors that weren't around for that.
It's almost like they want to feel and embrace the error that's gone.
Yeah.
That's cool, you know. It unfortunately tells me I'm getting very old.
We all are.
But it's very cool. And the fact that there are remnants from that time still available.
Right.
Even makes it more cool. So we're a movie company, and the fact that we have some movies that were around at that time, and the fact that people are actually interested in it, I think people are more interested in buying something like that than me putting out a brand new Seduction Cinema film.
Wow. Well, I believe you actually commissioned the Polonia brothers to do Splatter Beach, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. That was an interesting project. Tell us some insider info on that one.
Well, I produced it. I assembled the cast. I basically said to Mark and John, I would like Misty Monday and Erica Smith to be in this film.
Right.
And Brett Piper can shoot it. And we're going to pack these people up and ship them out to you.
Right.
And then you're going to make your movie. It was a low-budget film. I love producing. I do. I love putting people together to make movies. And that's kind of how that happened. And that was the last film Misty Monday did for us. As a matter of fact, she's called Erin Brown in the film.
Right.
Only because, you know, I thought, okay, you know, she's really supporting this Erin Brown name. Great, we'll call her Erin Brown. Doesn't matter because people still call her Misty Monday anyway.
Right.
There is no separation. My studio owns the name Misty Monday.
Right.
So in order for someone to make a Misty Monday movie, they need to license the title from us.
Right.
So get in touch with me if you want to make a movie. If you have Erin Brown, you want the name. And we license it cheap. So that's I'm very much a believer in putting something together and letting that filmmaker go.
Right.
You know, Brett Piper the same. It's like, I'm a producer, but I don't breathe down people's necks. First of all, if I'm hiring them to make a movie for me, that means I have trust in them.
Right.
And since I have trust in them, my guidelines are very specific. You know, it has to be of this quality, it has to be that. You know, this person has to be in it. Has to be professional.
Right.
But that's it. Same thing with Jacob Ennis, Red River.
Right.
It's like, okay, I saw Jacob's previous film, Stash.
Right.
It's like, Jacob, you're great. Here's the money, da-da-da. We approve the script. Goodbye. Go make it. You know, that's what they do. And I think that's wonderful because I allow people to go out and make their movies.
Right.
And I always encourage them to use that movie as a sort of stepping stone to doing bigger movies.
Right.
I'm very upfront about that of like, look, we're not going to, there's not a lot of money here.
Right.
And we're probably not going to make a lot of money with this. You should take this movie and go bang on some doors in Hollywood, you know, to get some big shot.
Right.
To like, hey, I made this movie, and it's nationally distributed, and they'll look at it, and hopefully they'll see the talent and give that filmmaker a bigger budget.
Right.
So that's what excites me.
Yes. So the John McBride films, I understand you putting out Cannibal Camp out, particularly alongside your releases of the Andres Schnaas and Todd Sheets films, which similarly wallow in some rather over-the-top gore. But it looks like you recognize what I see as the true merits of the film as well, which is the likability and the DIY spirit of the cast and production. I'm making this inference because you also released the utterly bloodless, if quite entertaining, Woodchipper Massacre as well in its own standalone release. Did you have any real dealings with John, or did you come in contact with him via the Polonias, since the bulk of his later work was, in fact, in starring and co-directing capacity on their films?
I met John through the Polonia brothers, and we licensed Splatter Farm. I think it was just a natural progression of meeting John. I've spoken to John on the phone quite a few times, and we had Camp Motion Picture was, you know, up and running. Hey, let's put out these movies. Woodchipper Massacre is like a PG it's PG because of the woodchipper. It's a PG movie. It has a beautiful sensibility to it.
Yeah.
A lot of people like, that's my favorite Camp Motion Picture movie. Woodchipper Massacre. It's sort of like a Goonies kind of thing, right?
Right. I actually prefer it over Cannibal Camp.
Really?
But I didn't already say.
Cannibal Camp is amazingly gory.
Yes. But, you know, that's if you were a gore hound. And me personally, I actually watch these sort of films because they're entertaining. Because I like, you know, the atmosphere, because I like the DIY spirit. You know, there's something about them that catches my eye, as opposed to, you know, somebody who's a gore hound going in there. And there's a lot of gore hounds out there. I know a lot of them personally. They're just going there to see, oh, I want to see this guy's eye get gouged out. I think it's a little twisted, but, right. You know, it's out there. Tim Ritter, who's easily the second most prolific director in shot on video cinema after the Polonius, what led to your release of his Killing Spree? It's a very entertaining film, and the lead actor, Asbestos Felt, which apparently is his legal name, is quite over the top. You know, beyond its intrinsic merits as a standalone film, why'd you take on this film only and not, say, his Truth or Dare series?
I'm very fond of Tim Ritter, and I have a lot of respect for Tim Ritter. And we both started, actually, he started a little earlier than I did. You know, I was out there shooting Ghoul School. Tim already had Killing Spree done. But I remember looking at Killing Spree and admiring, you know, shot on 16mm, a lot of coverage at the time.
Right.
And when I was putting out the camp releases, why put out Killing Spree? It's sort of like the same question of why put out Ghoul School. It was out already. Killing Spree has been out many times.
Right.
I just wanted to be a completist in the sense that I felt a tie to Killing Spree that kind of is in the whole Ghoul School, the basement arena. I licensed it through an agent.
Okay.
I mean, I called Tim. Tim's like, oh, here, call this guy to license it. And I had some extras on that release that either were not on the previous release. So, I mean, what we have is the comprehensive release of Killing Spree.
Yes, very much so.
I also went back to his original master tape as opposed to using sub-generation tapes.
Right.
So I put in that extra expense so that I could have the best version out. And over the years, I've kept in touch with Tim. I have a great appreciation for his movies, and his other films are out already. Yeah, they're out. I mean, Killing Spree for me is the one.
Yeah, no, it definitely is special. I was just wondering why, because you're usually pretty comprehensive. Okay, here's a bunch of Joe Sarno films, here's a bunch of this, and it was just Killing Spree.
All of Tim's releases are out, I believe, through the Sub Rosa company.
Yeah, Sub Rosa's most of them.
That's up to Tim. I mean, I'm not big into sub-licensing through a third party. I really want to represent someone's library of films. And at some point, Tim wants to put all of his films in Camp Motion Pictures. That's something I would love to talk to him about.
Okay. How did you find out about the obscure Jill Zerberg film, Beauty Queen Butcher? I'd never even heard of this one. It came at the very end of the 80s shot on video boom, and it may actually have been the last of the shot on video releases from the 80s. It has a very different tone from most shot on video films. It's very comedic and bloodless. It's like a low-budget, more entertaining take on Heathers. And I wasn't honestly expecting to like this one very much, but I came out of the film loving it.
I'm, like, blown away by, like, the comprehensiveness of your questions. You may know more about my company than I do. The producer of Beauty Queen Butcher is Shane Partlow, and he produced the film and approached us in maybe the late 1990s to put it out. It was a film that was produced but never released. And when we licensed it, it sat because it really didn't have a place. We were trying to figure it was an odd bird. It's another PG-13 type movie.
Right.
And only now, as a matter of fact, on the next Alternative Cinema podcast, we're going to be talking about Beauty Queen Butcher, because now that everyone's rabid for this type of movie,
right.
This is a lost gem. This is a very unusual, well-made film.
Yes.
That's easy to watch. It's well cast. It's well shot. But it fell in the cracks.
Right.
Here in 2012, you know, I hope to make good on really promoting it. And it's all a matter of timing. And that's what's difficult from the perspective of a producer, because Beauty Queen Butcher's license expired, and I had a conversation with Shane about relicensing it. Very much from the heart of, listen, I want, this film belongs here.
Right.
You know, the opportunity it's going to have here is better than being anyplace else.
Right.
There are not many. I mean, how do you tell a filmmaker that there's no opportunity for their film? You know, it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult for me to tell myself this when, you know, it's like, okay, hey, I want to release Caress of the Vampire. Oh, Paige, who runs my home entertainment, will talk me down. It's like, there's no place for that right now. It was a late 90s movie. No one's into late 90s. It's out already. It's like, forget it.
Right.
And that's tough to deal with because you don't believe it. You're like, wait a minute, this is Caress of the Vampire. This is one of our most successful. It doesn't matter. It's like, wait, no one wants this now.
Right.
I think that something like Beauty Queen Butcher, first of all, it was produced 2 years too late.
Right.
If that was produced 1984 to 1989, I think it would have had a huge impact. But they produced an 80s movie in 1991.
Right.
Thank goodness it still fits in the Camp Motion Picture, you know, what's going on with Camp.
Right.
And I think it's a real shining it really shines. But out of the whole group, even with I consider decent box art, it never really caught fire. Like, it's not like Cannibal Camp Out. Like, for some reason, like, it's like a sleeper.
Yeah.
And I hope that in the next year or so that we could really, hey, man, you guys missed this.
Yeah, no, because I really liked it. But, again, I wasn't expecting to. I figured it was something totally different from what it ended up being.
Yeah.
And isn't that her only film?
Yes.
Yeah, so I don't know why that happened, because it was a good film. Gary Cohen, Video Violence was one of the most famous or infamous titles of the 80s shot on video genre. So there's no question why you go after that one. But tell us about the rediscovery, I think you already kind of did, of his more obscure Last House on the Left pastiche, Captives. I understand this originally came out on a small VHS label back in the 80s who failed to promote it or give it a true general distribution. So for all intents and purposes, like The Basement, it's something of a lost film. And yet, it's quite good. So tell us a little bit more about Gary, who has a background in community theater rather than cinema, yet produced a handful of rather memorable films.
Well, I'll say it again. Gary's great. He comes up. Maybe we see him every year or so. Comes up, and I'm like, come on, Gary, we'll take you out for Chinese. So Gary, after Video Violence, he was like, oh, I have this film, Captives. And I was like, ah. It just took a little bit of time, like maybe a year or so. And it was very similar to Video Violence. You know, it was like, okay, Gary, listen, Captives, let's do it. You know, and the same thing happened. You know, we made a deal. He delivered everything to us. And then it sat for like another 6 months till we kind of figure out like how to release this. Because that's the thing. You know, these days you release Captives on its own, and how do you get people to buy something?
Right.
You know, that's why I think that the Basement box is a 1-2 punch. You know, punches right in the face. Like, oh my God. It really is. There's something special about it because you're getting all the special content that's never around before. I mean,
right.
Good luck if you want to try to find the original Captives because the distribution was so poor.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I've seen on Facebook, anyone that has the original Captives, which was called like Mama's Home or Mama's House,
yeah,
just holds it up like a prize,
right,
because that's almost impossible to find. The content is unusual. It's like very different than Video Violence.
Right.
It's a tough sell. It's a tough sell on its own. No one wants to pay $20 for a DVD.
Yeah.
So let's put together the ultimate package. All the filmmakers, we all have the same belief that we just want to get behind it and support it and get it out there.
Right.
Not so much about how many units is it going to sell and how much money is this going to make. Because these days in the DVD business, it's pennies.
Yeah.
It's like, let's get this out the best possible way. And it's all from the perspective of, it's about the person buying it.
Right.
It's really about the fan. Like, we want to get this to you. We want you to see this.
Right.
You know, it's a very different mentality than releasing your fourth Seduction Cinema film in 1 month time in 2002.
Right.
Where you have this amazing platform of a Best Buy, and it's flying off the shelf because people are just buying discs. People are just buying format as opposed
right.
to buying
content.
So it has to be special, and once again, I'm happy that, you know, we have the opportunity to put this movie out. And
at the risk of sounding like a plug, if anybody out there is interested in 80s shot on video cinema at all, I strongly recommend you pick up the Basement box set. It really is flawless.
No, I've heard that from many people, and I'm not embarrassed about plugging it at all in the sense that I'm like, look, you know, you guys got to see this.
Yeah, very much.
Got to see this. I mean, that Tim O'Rourke gore in the basement with that... The scene in the classroom.
Right.
It's unheard of. You can't see that today.
No, not at all.
Today, you can't kill kids today. I tell you where you can see kids getting killed. You can see it in Beware Children at Play.
Right.
And The Basement. That's it.
That's it.
No one, who has the balls to do such crazy things?
It's true. So speaking overall, why do you think so few auteurs working in the medium of shot on video cinema actually hung in there or went on to bigger things? I mean, you have Tim O'Rourke, who moved on to Hollywood, and the two soldiers, you know, the Polonia brothers, Tim Ritter, who've been putting out films right through to this day. But most directors put out between 1 to 3 films before bowing out into, I guess, you know, apparent obscurity. It's not due to lack of talent or ability from what I'm seeing here.
Well, filmmakers who make 3 or 4 films and then disappear, you have to have amazing amount of patience. You have to be able to fail and pick yourself back up again. You have to have a thick skin, so if someone double-crosses you, that you're able to pick yourself up again and move forward and not hold grudges.
Right.
It's a very... I mean, it's the entertainment business, and you're dealing with personalities and egos of everybody, including your cast. your cast, your crew, everybody. It's a very difficult thing. You're dealing with personalities. And some people can't hack it, as far as I'm concerned. Some people can't hang in there and do it because, A, the money return on investment may not be what you expected.
Right.
Therefore, in between projects, if you're a filmmaker, you need to work. You know, you need to, and most people I know sort of did what I did, which is pick up a corporate job, you shoot a commercial. You know, it's a lot of hustle. That hustle combined with, let's say, if you want to actually settle down and have a life.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to have a wife and children, it's a great conflict. And it's very rare that you could find it all working together in the sense that, you know, Mark Polonia is driven to make movies, but he's making movies where he when he can make it.
Right.
As opposed to being a full-time director. You know, I think of guys like Jim Minorski, who he's a full-time director.
Right.
You know, and you have to have be of a certain mindset in order to do that, you know, and be able to do whatever and maybe make some films you don't want to make. It's very difficult. You have to really be stubborn, I think, to continue to do it. And you have to have it has to be burning in you.
Right.
To continue to make movies.
It was from the Third Eye Cinema. Tonight we have Mike Brasso of Pop Cinema, formerly known as EI Entertainment. In our final section, we'll be talking about his film-based photography website and the future of DVD media. We're at Third Eye Cinema on the Pop Online Network. I'm Bob.
In addition to running Pop Cinema and its myriad sub-labels, you become active in podcasting, with one devoted to low-budget independent and genre cinema, which is a major area of interest for me personally, obviously, and another site and podcast devoted to the vanishing art of film-based photography. Tell me about the Alternative Cinema podcast first.
Sure. Well, I started as a broadcaster in the 80s, and now I'm a broadcaster again. So it seemed like a natural thing to do, especially because I felt that with Alternative Cinema, once into the late 2000s, I felt I kind of lost touch with the customer. I lost touch with, you know, the people that have been supporting my company all these years, and I wanted to really just get on the horn, so to speak,
right,
and broadcast, do a broadcast talking about all these crazy movies. And we're in our third year now, and it started out really slow in the sense that, you know, you don't have many listeners.
Right.
But it's like it was like a snowball rolling down the hill. And then it took a few years to kind of get a format going in the sense that John Fedeli's sort of sidekick, Color.
Right.
And then I brought William Hellfire in, which is natural because William started with me and still has amazing interest in films, especially foreign horror films.
Right.
He really has his finger on the pulse. His girlfriend, Erin Russ, has been in a few independent films.
Right.
And occasionally she sits in as well. So as one of our listeners, Noel Anderson, Scotch,
okay,
he's a DJ up in Fargo, North Dakota. It was actually a few listeners that kept me going doing the podcast because they would actually write in and express how they loved listening to the show because I was a little wobbly about it, like, oh, I don't know, you know.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a certain amount of entertaining involved. You know, you're an entertainer.
Right.
Whether you're releasing a film or doing a podcast, I mean, you're taking up someone's time and I don't take that for granted. I never dismiss the fact that someone's listening to me or buying one of my movies. It's like, wow, I really appreciate them spending time listening to or watching something that I was directly involved with. And
right.
It's like, I want to be able to give something to that person that they, maybe that means something to them.
Right.
So if it's a horror film that means something to them, great. You know, because I remember I was influenced by Night of the Living Dead. I mean, it blew my mind when
right.
I first saw it. I was like, oh my God. So if I can get on the horn once a month to talk about stuff, and I could use some of my experiences in the business to sort of make light of, you know, what we've been doing here. Now that Alternative Cinema is distributing so many labels,
right,
there's endless amount of stuff to talk about. Hey, you know what's out this week by Severn Films? You're not going to believe this. Sledgehammer coming out.
Right.
You know, the young guy who put that out, you know, I got him in here, and like, how did you find this movie? You know, what's going on? What? And he is a very similar scenario. He's just passionate about this movie. He found the filmmaker. You know, it's like, that's an amazing story, and I think people need to kind of hear, you know, the behind the music of movie.
Exactly.
Of ultra low budget filmmaking, you know, something that the films that you can't even talk about at home because your mom and dad don't know what you're talking about. Like, what? These films exist? I mean, my old man, he couldn't get through 5 minutes of anything, any of this stuff. He doesn't understand, doesn't know what it is, you know. You try to explain it, they don't get it. It's of a certain fan that really enjoys.
And that's what I'm trying to do with this show, is get this stuff out there
for
those who know it. I was actually lucky because my father was into horror films from
day
one. So we watched this stuff together when I was a kid. But, you know, obviously he's passed on. So
it's sort of like a fan who can appreciate a train wreck.
Right.
I mean, look, some of these movies are train wrecks.
That's true. That's
but
true.
You could watch it and be like, appreciate or actually enjoy a train wreck.
Right.
You know,
there's something about it that says, you know what, this was bad, sure, but I enjoyed it.
Doris Wishman's Hideout in the Sun, you know, I didn't know Doris Wishman, but from what I can tell, she was like a dead serious filmmaking.
Right.
And be horrified. What are you laughing at? There's nothing funny on the screen. It's like, that film is a train wreck.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it's a laugh out loud movie, you know, and that could bring joy to people, then great, you know? It's like, I can't escape it. Unfortunately, I was tainted at a young age by WOR-TV,
yes.
WPIX,
right.
WNEW.
Same here.
Would play all these crazy movies.
Late night, early morning.
Count Yorga.
Even in the early afternoon on ABC, they used to have the afternoon movie.
A certain person, I think, is attracted to this kind of movie. It's like, I can try to dismiss it. But I can't. It's in me. It's part of me. I can't. So I feel compelled to do the podcast just to talk to people. And I finally, after 3 years, people are starting to write in.
Right.
Be like, come on. I want to hear from you. Write us a letter. What's going on? You know? Become part of the show. Like, we have a few people write in every show.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of the show.
And, you know, in terms of, like, we're talking about here, in terms of these bad films being good, I even turned my wife into a Doris Wishman fan. Not because they're good, but because, you know, it's so cheesy. You got, oh, wait, she's filming somebody's feet.
Yeah.
Oh, there's some bric-a-brac. Oh, there's, somebody's talking out of sync. We're not filming the people that are on the screen. You know, it's the same plots, the same room every time. But nonetheless, there's something there that's like, wow, this is great. You know, I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah.
That you just don't find in mainstream films nowadays. That's a rule. So now, in terms of the film photography podcast, is this a viable medium at this point in history? You know, I know Eastman Kodak shut down production earlier this year, and you just can't find a one-hour photo film developing shop or kiosk anymore. You also mentioned the pleasures of the Polaroid Instapak, and I believe Polaroid's long gone at this point as well. Where do you go to get things developed, or are you strictly old school, like with f-stop photography, with your own home darkroom and the acid wash?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I'm going to pull out my Polaroid camera. My life has come full circle. In reality, it has. It has. I started out being a cameraman in motion picture film. I always shot still photography. And back in the early 90s, photography was film photography. There was no other. There's no choice. You want to shoot stills, you use film.
Right.
With the dawn of the digital revolution, I wasn't there for that because I put my still camera down when I started my motion picture companies.
Right.
So for years, like 15 years, I barely picked up a still camera. When I went into my closet and pulled my camera gear out in 2009, all of a sudden I was in a strange new world. Here's my camera gear, still works great, and it's like all of a sudden I'm in a niche.
Right.
Like, wait a minute, now I'm a film photographer, I'm not a photographer anymore.
Right.
Here's a Polaroid automatic land camera that predates anything I ever used in my life, mid-1960s.
Wow.
Well, Eastman Kodak still produces film. Most people don't know this. They have plants all over the world. They've certainly gotten smaller.
Right.
And they're financially struggling right now.
Right.
But they're still producing. The Polaroid Corporation stopped making film in 2009. The company filed for bankruptcy, and all of its assets and names were sold.
Right.
So I believe like Citibank owned the name Polaroid, and then they sold it to another entity. So the new Polaroid is not the old Polaroid.
Right.
And they're promoting digital
right
now. Yes, film is viable, and it appeals to artists and to young people in college who grew up digital.
Right.
And, I mean, there is a parallel to the movies we've been talking about in the sense that people grew up digital and didn't realize that this stuff existed.
Right.
An indie company bought a Polaroid factory and started making film again.
Wow.
And Fujifilm makes a film for this old dog here, which I'm going to, you know, when we're done podcasting, I'll take your picture with it.
Oh, okay.
So it's amazing growing interest in using film. And because this was such, I was so passionate about it,
right.
And I was already producing the Alternative Cinema podcast, I started talking about film so much on the AC podcast early on. John Fedeli Cole was like throwing things at me.
Right.
Enough about the Polaroid. You know? So I branched out and I said, you know what? Welcome to the Film Photography Podcast in October of 2009.
Right.
You know, which at that time, digital was so in the mainstream and film was dying. And in a matter of 3 years, that's really turned around to now film sales are up. Even though everything's been scaled down, film sales are up. And every day, some kid in college is discovering, like, oh, my God, you mean I could use this camera? Or
right.
How does this work? Or, you know, something tangible, something you could hold in your hand.
Right.
It's part of a lifestyle of someone who sets up a darkroom in their house.
Right.
Because digital is great, and you can take a picture, but it's not a craft.
Right.
You know, and filmmaking and making stills on film is a craft, and there's so many things associated with it that you control.
Right.
You shoot your film using an old camera. You're deciding the f-stop. You're
right.
Manually deciding how much light to let into the hit the film. And then you can either bring that to a lab or you can develop the film yourself and then make decisions again. How do I want to print this? Printmaking is a whole art form. So
right.
It's amazing to me, and it's very I get a lot of satisfaction out of it.
And how about with the Polaroid? Are you able to develop that in a darkroom as well? Because that's a different process altogether.
Absolutely. Polaroid is instant film,
okay.
And it's a chemical process that, you know, for example, with this camera in front of me, I take the picture. I'm going to pull the image out of here, out of the side of the camera, and then the film is sandwiched between a negative and a positive, and then you wait 2 minutes,
right.
And then you peel the picture.
Okay.
Very old school, like 1950s, 1960s. And then, of course, there's the Polaroid cameras, which you probably remember. The Polaroid one-step, the film pops out the front.
Right.
And people shake it, but you're not supposed to.
Right.
And that develops before your eyes.
Right.
So that, you know, there's no developing with that photography. It's just a matter of letting it develop in front of you.
Exactly,
it's instant
yeah.
photography. It's instant gratification. And what's exciting about it now is that people are rediscovering it. Because if you go to a party and you bring an instant camera with instant prints,
right.
It's like fun.
Right, because you can show them around to everybody, right?
Yeah, there. You have them right there, or you take a picture and stick it on your fridge.
But the only problem with Polaroid that I found, at least those Instapacks we're talking about, is that over time it tends to fade. You know, the colors start to go green, and I've got a number of Polaroids in books and on walls and things that just totally change color.
Well, nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
In the sense that digital technology is so new, and there are many ways that you can either store your files, you know, up in a cloud.
Right.
Rent a backup service to back up your discs, or
right.
If you're serious about photography, you'll have 3 backups of your files. But there's no charted longevity of those files, of corrupt files.
True.
And to be a true film historian, for your digital images, you'd actually get it printed to film,
right.
Or a negative, make a negative from it to actually preserve it.
Right.
Which I'm sure Annie Leibovitz and all these people now who are shooting on digital, there has to be some kind of film backup.
Right.
Hollywood is the same. A major motion picture is shot, if it's shot on film or digital, either way it's edited digitally, and film prints are struck and put into underground vaults. I know it sounds creepy, but it's true.
Yeah.
Disney Company has vaults all over the world.
Right.
So if an earthquake takes out California, we still have Snow White.
Right.
It'll be somewhere in Germany.
Right.
So film, like anything else, will fade in time, and the preservation of it, because a print can last for 100 years, but
right.
If it's on a wall and sun's hitting it, it's going to take it down much quicker.
Right.
So, same thing with Polaroid. I have some Polaroids that from the 70s that my parents stored in a box, and they're as crisp as they were the day they were taken.
Yeah.
I'm happy you asked.
Well, in a sense, you know, being stuck on film photography and such, it's almost like being a devotee of the Theremin or the Hammond B3 or the early tape loop synthesizers.
Oh, my God, yes.
Most people acknowledge the sound is better and kind of irreplicable, but they don't make them anymore, much less service them. So I guess there's the thematic continuity here, like we were saying with the earlier discussion about the inclusion of a VHS with a basement. That was a little bit more of a marketing gimmick, but you thankfully did include the same film as DVD because that's the way I watch it.
Yes.
But what are your thoughts in general about technological, quote, progress? Are we better off in a lot of ways with the older media, or is this pure nostalgia?
I think it's a combination of nostalgia. If you're a child and you see an Abbott and Costello movie, I mean, to you it's new, and entertainment is entertainment.
Right.
If you're that young, it's sort of like me discovering Beatle albums. My aunt had the Beatle albums.
Right.
She moved on in her life, so Beatle albums were just sitting in a heap. And, you know, I put on Sgt. Pepper when I was, like, fifth grade.
Right.
By that time, the Beatles were already broken up. So it's just kind of discovery of something that has very long legs. And in our pop culture, I believe, you know, things that are worth the test of time.
Right.
But in that, there's so many subgenre and niches. I mean, for example, in the 1960s, there were an amazing amount of 45 RPM records pressed of garage bands.
Yes.
Obscure, they're on indie labels, and you can still find them in collections and whatnot, but
right.
There's not a lot of information about them out there. And now it's a matter of, will they survive the actual test of time?
Right.
Will those masters get lost?
Right.
So it's a whole subculture of discovery of older stuff, and people who like older movies tend to maybe not like the new stuff.
Right.
Like me, I don't really like new Hollywood.
Same here.
I like Hollywood, like 1960s, late 60s, you know, the generation spurred on by Easy Rider.
Right.
You know, the whole type of filmmaking that happened in the late 60s, maybe through the mid-70s. I mean,
right.
Those are Hollywood movies, and I can't believe they're so good.
Exactly. That's a big thing for me.
Yeah.
You know, what I was going to say is, even someone as retro-oriented as myself, Canon does recognize some clear advantages to the new media, per se, and what it can allow you to do in terms of image and sound manipulation, as well as storage, because obviously it's compact. But there's something of a loss of the soul in material that's actually produced on and for the new media, as opposed to, say, analog-based studio recording or shooting on film and video. So are there any last thoughts or anything you'd like to promote or plug?
I feel my hands are really full in dealing with what I'm dealing. I mean, I'm doing my absolute best to preserve, everything that's in my library
right
now, of getting it out there. And it's kind of scary for me in a sense that almost soon it'll be a next generation of, and will there be an opportunity to get films in my library out to maybe the next generation of Misty Monday fans.
Right.
You know, there's so many, pop culture is so different now in the sense that when I was a kid, it was very contained. You had your 13 channels of TV.
Right.
You had your transistor radio.
Right.
You had your records, and you go to a theater to see a movie, and that was it.
Yeah.
Now it's a strange new world where everything is in the palm of your hand, you know.
You're
check
right.
the weather. You could check your email. You could watch a YouTube video.
Right.
I think my goal, as I settle into old age, not yet. Not yet.
Not that old.
No, not that old. Is for young people to, stop, take a breath.
Right.
And don't be so frenetic. And, you know, spend the time with this film camera to open it up, to look at it, to see what it does, and take your time doing something as opposed to tripping over yourself to tweet about this, that, or the other thing. It's like, do it for yourself, because there's much more satisfaction in being crafty, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, even in making a movie, it's like, I'm not saying you have to shoot on film, but there's a lot to be said for taking your time and not being in such a rush. I mean, I believe it's maybe in a few years that I think younger people will actually wake up and say, oh, my God, kind of discover that there's craft behind a lot of things, and you could do things much slower, like discovering a film camera. That's my hope, and that's, you know, anything I can do to help a young filmmaker, I do. Most time they don't listen to me. You know, I'm trying to slow them down. You know, they produce a film, and not only are they producing their next film, forget about it. They're already on their second.
Yes.
You know, there. You know, there needs to be a slowdown process of this is not get it out as quick as possible.
Right.
Forget about any markets or DVD or anything like that. It's just a matter of your own craft. You need to love and support what you're doing and spend some time with that.
Right.
From a very old-timey exhibition type of scenario. If you're going to make a movie, spend the proper time screening it. Because
right.
now with digital transmission in the theater,
right.
it's easier than ever to take your digital movie and actually show it in the theater.
Right.
That hurdle has been jumped. So now that every theater in America in the next year or so is going to be digital, you as a filmmaker can actually do a real theatrical screening and not look down upon because the new Harry Potter movie was screened digital.
Right.
So that's my that's what I try to do. I try to be as helpful because I've been through it.
Right.
And I've had every success that I've had maybe as many more failures. And you just keep pick yourself up and go. So if I can offer some help, and maybe, you know, I'm here to help. So,
and I agree with you about the rush aspect where people are kind of tripping over their own feet to get to the next project. Because
yeah.
even in the field of music, I notice bands now are just dropping them one after the other. And there's no time to craft out. Oh, look, we have to wait 2 or 3 years for the next album to come out. And will it be even better or will it be a change in direction? There's no time for that. It's just 1, 2, 3, 4.
No, it's patience. Yeah, I'm not up on the bands new bands as you are, but I believe the model is all the same, and same exists for what I'm doing with film photography. I launched a podcast, and I can't expect that podcast to be successful. And because I already had the history of the film business, I knew that I had to work beyond hard promoting that podcast and getting out there in order for that podcast to catch.
Right.
And I want it to catch because I want people to discover film.
Right.
As long as the heart is in the matter and you could realize that, and I think bands are an excellent example because it's worse than filmmaking in the sense that, I don't know if this is true or not, but I would guess that to be in a band, it's even more ego-driven, trying to achieve success. But as you mentioned, my God, you have to give it years.
Right.
And I think people poop out before they give it an opportunity. Or sometimes I've seen this before, bands that are on the verge of breaking out
right.
break up because of internal...
Yeah. Well, that's always been the case.
Yeah. But. Can I give out my email address?
Sure, go right ahead.
If anyone out there has actually, at this point, is still listening, not because of your show,
no,
but because of me, you can reach me at podcast@alternativecinema.com. I'd be more than happy to hear from you. And as you mentioned, I do have my own podcast, Alternative Cinema Podcast. And be great to hear from you.
Well, Mike, it's been a pleasure. And thanks for coming here to join us on Third Eye Cinema. And we can have you back in the future.
Great. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our up-close and personal interview with Mike Rasso. Next week on Third Eye Cinema, Arch Hall Jr. If you would like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician who'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio.
What's in store for your business this week at Staples?
Doing business like a CEO while saving like a CFO.
Staples has all the supplies you need to run your business like a boss at prices that'll make your bookkeeper smile.
Now that is an achievement.
Everything from markers and pens to 2019 desk calendars.
And right now, a 12-pack of Sharpie markers and an 8-pack of Expo dry erase markers are only $4.99 each.
At Staples, where there's a whole lot in store. Ends 1/19/19 in store only.